percent. Sunshine with 68 degrees, Racine, 65 in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And it's always exciting when we can spend some time on the morning show talking with Dr. Thomas Carr, who has been a part of the faculty at Carthage for quite a few years. In fact, how many years, Dr. Carr?
18.
Yeah. And we have spoken with Dr. Carr primarily in his capacity as director of the Center for Paleontology at Carthage. And we often in the fall will talk with Professor Carr and sometimes with others as well if that particular summer included one of the exciting dinosaur expeditions, if you will, out in rural Montana. And this was yet another summer in which that activity took place. In this case, over the course of some 4 weeks, and more than two dozen different people involved in this, many of them Carthage students. And I'm really happy to have not only Dr. Carr with us today, but also Andrew Gable, who is actually a Carthage graduate of 2020 and someone who's been a really important part of the paleontology program at Carthage, and for a period of time, actually, as a part-time preparator. And he was along for this latest so-called dinosaur dig and has been hard at work on a whole lot of different aspects to this particular undertaking. And it was an undertaking that included work on a beautiful Triceratops remain, as well as a juvenile T-Rex and lots of other things that were found. And to make it even a more exciting time, there were actually several film crews that were on hand as well. So we're going to be finding out about all of that as well, some of the work that they have been doing at the Kenosha Public Museum. And of course, we will also spend a little bit of time talking about concerns around funding, which have been unfortunately a reality that the program has had to deal with over the last year. So we have lots to talk about, and I'm so glad to be able to have this conversation today. Professor Thomas Carr and Andrew Gable, we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Thanks. Good morning.
Thanks for having us.
And we should say we're welcoming both of them back to the morning show. Dr. Carr, of course, has been on all kinds of times, and Andrew at least once has been with us when he was along on one of these expeditions. Dr. Carr, for the sake of somebody who is not particularly acquainted with what we're talking about today, a newcomer maybe to the morning show who isn't maybe acquainted even with the program at Carthage, let's start with that and then talk about these memorable trips that have occurred roughly every other summer for the last few years. But let's start with the paleontology program itself.
Sure. So I was hired back in 2004, so I goofed when I said 18 years. It's really been 20, but the field program's been running for 18 years. I was hired to start a paleontology program at Carthage that included opportunities of research, lab experience, and field experience for students. And I had all that in place very rapidly. And we had our first expedition to our area in Montana in 2006. Hmm. And we've been returning there ever since. And in those days, the program was completely funded by the college with regard to their agreement with the city. So the program is actually a collaboration between the college and the city that both signed to. And the college's responsibility was to hire a paleontologist, that's me, to run, you know, those three legs of the stool. And also they were obligated to hire an assistant to the paleontologist or preparator, the fossil preparator. And that happened in 2011 when, you know, I demonstrated that we had a thriving field program and I needed a staff person you know, prep those fossils and train students to prep the fossils and help run the field program. And that's what the college brought to table. On the city side, they provided us space, office space, lab space, and collections. And together we applied for and received federal repository status since I collect on federal lands. Mm. The city also runs a dinosaur discovery museum, so that's where our office and lab are located in the lower level there. And so the city also staffs that building, maintains it. There's an exhibit of the evolution of birds from meeting dinosaurs that I designed. And, you know, they installed, and there's a little gift shop in there as well. So it's been working really well, this collaboration. It's been very quite smooth. We sort of operate somewhat independently of each other, but I think it's cooperative as well. Those points of cooperation are expressed in things like the public displays of fossils that we have. We have several exhibits of real fossils from Montana that showcase discoveries of one of our late volunteers, Andrew Parisi, and also highlight some of the animals like crocodiles and turtles for the public to come and see. And it's been a very, I think, good workable relationship for many years. And, you know, sort of a nice perk was that the city would pony up for providing a U-Haul and a driver. One of their staff would fly out and pick up a U-Haul truck that the city would cover. And they did that for us since 2006, which was sort of a really nice thing. They didn't have to do it, but they did.
Hmm. So this has happened quite regularly, and has it been every other year without fail, or did something called COVID interrupt that procession of expeditions?
Right, so we did have one hiccup. Actually, the basic pattern is that we're out there for 2 years in a row, two summers in a row, then one summer off, and that tracks my J-term schedule. And we've actually had years where we've gone, say, 5 years in a row because we had concerns about fossils that were really vulnerable to erosion, and we had to go out and rescue those. I couldn't live with letting them, you know, erode out for a summer. During COVID, so we're out there last time in 2022. Actually, we're on schedule. I don't think we've actually lost. I don't think COVID affected us.
I think COVID was serendipitously like on the off year.
Right. Well, thank you, COVID, for doing at least something nice for us. Yes, yeah. Very good. Andrew, let's remind people of who you are. Tell us a little bit about what drew your interest to Carthage in the first place, and was it specifically for paleontology, or is that something you discovered after getting there?
Sure. My name is Andrew Gable. I am an alumnus of Carthage College of 2020. When I was at Carthage, I actually was a double major in classical archaeology and political science, minored in Latin. It was actually paleontology was one of the things that drew me to Carthage in the first place, but I didn't study it at Carthage. I did take the J-term while I was an undergrad student there. But I did decide after the fact that what I really wanted to do was something where paleontology intersected with archaeology. To begin with, I kind of found myself choosing between one or the other. And at the time, I had this idea about, and no disrespect to political science or anything like that, is a legitimate thing to study, but I didn't really realize until too late that that wasn't really for me. It's just at the time when I thought it might be, archaeology made a little bit more sense to study alongside that. But I decided after the fact I'd like to do something at the intersection of archaeology and paleontology. So I've been spending a lot of time volunteering at the museum since then to kind of make up for lost time in a little bit of a way. But I was given the position of assistant preparator while that position existed. I served in that role for a bit over half a year in 2023. And prior to that and after that, I have been a regular volunteer at the museum, at least 6 hours a week, sometimes significantly more. And then when this position began to reach a close because of the end of its grant funding. The former holder of this position, Dr. Megan Seitz, she accepted a job elsewhere just for a little bit more job stability and everything like that, because the end was in sight at the time. So I applied for this position after her departure, and I had it for the rest of the extent of the grant funding.
Right.
And the position's official title in my role was field assistant. So I ran the dig alongside Dr. Carr as basically his second in command.
Excellent. Can you just say a quick word about this notion of an intersection between paleontology and archaeology? Is that what you were saying?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, you don't have to be terribly specific, but just what in general is the intersection between those fields?
Sure. Well, to begin with, if anybody listening may not be aware, the general gist of the difference between paleontology and archaeology is that archaeology deals with past human remains and human cultures, and paleontology is with fossils in general, and not typically applied to humans except if they're other animals or earlier in human evolution. But so dinosaurs and everything like that is generally under the purview of paleontology and not archaeology. But intersections do exist because in a sense you could consider archaeology as being the paleontology of a single group, really. And so intersections between archaeology and paleontology include things like zooarchaeology, above the Silurian age. That's a study of animal remains in human-occupied sites, human-animal interactions in terms of domestication, hunting, making artifacts out of animal remains and bones, things like that. Another intersection is paleoanthropology, human evolution. And there are also some other things getting further into the weed of it, like use of fossils as ritual artifacts. That's happened in multiple cultures, as well as in folk memory, things like oral traditions of late prehistoric animals, like and Pleistocene, possibly making their way into some earlier and ancient, but nonetheless historic myths and legends. So there are quite a few intersections between the two. They aren't really all that different. They're adjacent in a lot of ways, and they do use not necessarily one-to-one on everything, but quite a few of the same methods for a lot of different things.
Sure, absolutely, and I can see how one could fold nicely into the other. I'm actually reminded of a story from right here of the remains of the mammoth that are housed at the museum, and how at some point in time, if I remember correctly, a discovery was made about those remains, and that very likely that animal, I think, had been butchered.
Yes, exactly. And that is an excellent example of zooarchaeology. Yeah, the Hebeor mammoth. That's like it was named after the property of the guy where it was found. But yeah, that was a hunting and butchering site. So that is definitely zooarchaeological.
Sure. And my understanding, amateur understanding, is that somebody with one expertise could look at those remains and wouldn't even be really thinking about that. And then somebody else with a different kind of expertise could look at the same remains and immediately notice that this animal was butchered. And of course, that unlocked a whole body of knowledge and understanding that wouldn't have been unlocked otherwise.
Exactly, yeah. There are quite a few sites and specimens from the Pleistocene, the Ice Age, really. And that takes up the bulk of human history. There are quite a few sites and specimens from that time where things absolutely can be missed if either archaeologists and paleontologists aren't in close collaboration, or there aren't people looking at it that have some degree of competence in both fields.
Right. Fascinating. Well, for those of you just joining us, we are talking today on the morning show with just now Andrew Gable, a 2020 graduate of Carthage and someone who's been a really important part of the paleontology program there, and Dr. Thomas Carr, director of the paleontology program. And we want to dig in now, so to speak, into the most recent trip made out to rural Montana. In a nutshell, Dr. Carr, remind our listeners about exactly this site of federal land on which you have been doing this exploration now for so many years.
Yeah, we do our field work in southeastern Montana on federally managed lands that are under the auspices of the Bureau of Land Management, or BLM. We apply for permits each year that we go out to collect, and at the end of that year, we write up a field report of everything we found. So I'm currently going through the process of looking at everything, every little bit, and cataloging all of that for the benefit of the people of the United States. And so, so we collect on many square miles of public lands in southeastern Montana. We're permitted to do what's called general survey, which is looking for new discoveries and picking things up from the ground that are actively eroding. If we find a skeleton, then we apply for a quarry permit, and we had about four of those in hand for this year, although realistically we know that we'll probably only manage to deal with one or two of those, but we need a buffer just in case we're super efficient or if a locality wipes out where we think there's something or a lot, but there really isn't, and we're done quicker than we imagine. So we had two main targets this summer. So we had a juvenile T-Rex discovery back in 22. And that's important because juveniles are very rare. T-Rex itself is rare to begin with. It's fossil records bias toward large adults. At least we think they're large adults. A recent study has come out suggesting that we haven't yet seen the largest of the large. But regardless of that, juveniles are rare. There's only about four or five in real museums. And so this was very significant. And so we had a student pick up bits of skull, hind leg, and vertebral column. And that was on the second last day of 22. And so we've been waiting 2 years to go back to see if there's anything else. And the best possible outcome is that there's a skeleton in the hill. And so on our second day out there, we headed straight for that locality and found that the hillside was completely covered in bone debris, completely covered, including bits of teeth of our animal. Mm-hmm. And so I had assigned students and our volunteer to pick up fragments and put them in bags while I scurried up the hill looking for bones sticking out of the hillside. Because if there was that, then there's a skeleton to collect. And unfortunately, there was nothing aside from the debris. Mm-hmm. And we've been working ourselves up for 2 years. Like, it really is agnostic. I call it Schrodinger's T-Rex. It both does and does not exist. And there still is the possibility that maybe there's a skeleton there, but the timing was just bad that we didn't. It might just be covered by a millimeter of sediment. We'd never see it. But the great part is that we picked up over 1,000 fragments, and that is an accurate estimate that Andrew's been cleaning up over the past couple of weeks, and has made all of our bones pretty much that we picked up in 22. They're now a little bit more complete.
So I was going to ask you why you were using the word debris, but yeah. The longer you've been talking, the clearer it has become that what we're talking about are mostly or maybe entirely fragments. I mean, parts of things that have broken apart.
Yeah, the process, erosion is terribly destructive. I mean, as soon as a dinosaur bone is exposed to elements, it's exposed to rain, wind, ice, freeze, and thaw. And, you know, in very quick order, bones are reduced to little cubes. It's kind of there's this sort of governing pattern of the way they splinter and fracture. They look like little ice cubes in some cases. And so, as soon as a bone is exposed, it starts to break apart and sort of becomes part of the landscape. And unless you know what you're looking for, you'll walk right past that. So really lucky that Mason had the experience. He took the field course a number of years ago, came back as a volunteer. So he had the search image for dinosaur bone, and that was a really good morning. Like, And so ultimately we have this fantastic jigsaw puzzle to reassemble, and we are having success. The nasals are more complete. That's the skull bone, the top of the snout. There's really important information there regarding maturity, how T-Rex grew up. We were able to put together parts of the shin together for the past couple of years. We had two main sections of the shin that were separate, and then with these new bits, they're now together. And then the ankle end of that tibia is now more complete by the day. And we also have part of the knee region represented by a bone called the fibula that Andrew's been able to has found additional pieces, making that more complete. So, you know, I'm really happy we went back. There wasn't a skeleton. I mean, the Hell Creek's kind of like that. It's hit or miss. But I'm grateful whatever new information we were able to collect and reassemble, because that gives us insight into how T-Rex grew up.
So, Andrew, give us some idea of kind of the nuts and bolts of dealing with debris in
this
kind of a situation, and particularly what your work was as preparator on site in terms of dealing with debris. And maybe you can tell us also about how you deal with debris once you've removed it from the site and have it back here in Kenosha.
I see. Well, on the site specifically, as Dr. Carr mentioned, he assigned students to specific lanes, and this was their second day. They hadn't been in the field prior to this except for the previous day. So I of course also supervised them as Dr. Carr was looking for an in situ bone. But yeah, we essentially spent roughly half the day just picking the hill completely clean of every single little fragment. And the largest of these is roughly fist size, a little bit smaller. But the smallest of these, I mean, they are very, very small. Like a step above grains of sand, small.
Wow.
Like just little splinters.
Like tiny little pebbles.
Yeah, and 1,000 is probably a low estimate, to be honest, because some of these are really, really small pieces.
Wow. And what happens to each tiny little bit of debris? I mean, does it go into something?
Yes. We put them all in a bag. We have the bags separated by the general area of where they were found. That's why we assign students to a lane partially, so that every bag is more or less one general area in the hill. The hill isn't especially big, but that does help a little bit with preparation, because it would stand to reason that things that are close together are more likely to fit together.
Right.
But then in the lab, they go through first a similar process as many other things that aren't in jackets, because these were all just surface collects, putting them in bags. They don't have to be wrapped up in plaster or anything like that.
Right.
They're brushed off of any other sand or sediments that would still be stuck to them. Then we have an air abrasion unit, which is essentially it blasts high pressurized air and an abrasion powder that's comparable to baking powder to get the last little bits of sediment off that can't be cleared off with a paintbrush, toothbrush, or dental pick. From there, we apply a mixture of paralloid and acetone. Paralloid is essentially a plastic that comes in a crystalline form, is dissolved in acetone to make it a liquid that coats all these little fragments to just further protect and stabilize them. And then from there, I do a systematic process. I basically take every little piece, hold it up to anything that looks remotely like it in terms of texture and everything like that, rotate it all around and see if there's a fit. And I actually still haven't got to that specific stage yet, because there are just so many of them. I'm still cleaning them up. But I just, in the process, I've found many fits already, like without even really going out of my way to look for them. Yeah. I am cleaning off this piece and I'm thinking, okay, well, because I've spent a lot of time looking at what we have already. I've done something similar with the bags that we had this past January. But before this dig, like just stuff from 2022. So while I'm cleaning while I'm cleaning the fragments, sometimes I'll find a piece where I'm like, oh, this looks like it probably fits onto the tibia over here. And there's already been dozens of fits like that so far. So the end of the tibia that we have, it was split into two parts. Both the condyles were separated, but we've already found enough to close that gap. It is all connected now. That's significant because it enables us to measure it. We could only really make an educated guess before, but now we have concrete information on that. And there are certain parts that fit onto the nasal that are new that are a little bit more diagnostic in terms of the specific age of the animal. Like
so your
structures that develop a little bit later, size, everything like that.
So you're both literally and figuratively filling in the gaps. I mean,
yes.
Filling in the gaps in larger pieces, and that's also filling in gaps of our understanding, or we come to a better understanding then of this part of this juvenile T-Rex then.
Absolutely.
Fascinating. And so clearly you didn't put each little shard into its own little bag. You would have had 1,000 bags.
Oh, no.
How many bags did you have? I mean, what are we talking about, roughly?
Off the top of my head, I think maybe about 20 or so is what they were divided into. Yeah.
Right. So many, many shards within each of those, depending on where they came from. And, of course, that would give you some idea that since these all came from here, these might all be part of the ankle or whatever it might be. And I mean,
more
possible.
Or less, yeah. Sure.
Yeah. Very good. So I know that also remains that you were excited about were of a triceratops.
Yeah.
And do I remember that this was also discovered several summers ago?
Yeah, it was discovered back in 21 by Mason Wotlia. Yeah, he's sort of a dino magnet. back in 21, we found a shoulder sticking out of a hill, a hill of sand, not a mud. And sand is a very different material to work in. It's loose, it's a bit more hazardous, but excavation could go a bit more quickly. In 21, we did some initial excavation, and it kept going into the hill, so we had to winterize it. And we went back for it in 22, but we found a second bone in the hill. I thought it was just one bone. I thought, oh boy, it's the second last day. We can't, this is too much for a day. This is impossible.
Mm.
So we winterized all of that, and that was backburnered until this summer. And so our first priority was the Rex. If there was a skeleton there, the whole crew would have been on it all summer. But that turned out, you know, there wasn't a skeleton, so we shifted on to Triceratops because that was vulnerable. It had a winter jacket on it, and that shoulder blade, even though it's big, it's, you know, still vulnerable to the elements. I didn't want any more freeze and thaw on it, even though it was protected from that. And so we removed the hill, assuming that we had an articulated skeleton. So a little second bone I thought was a vertebra in anatomical position relative to the shoulder. And, you know, my thinking was this is going to be an astonishing level of work. And if we have a whole month, maybe we can do it. And we removed the hill with the students. They were very good. We were very systematic. We split the group into two, and each group would dig for 20 minutes. And
just going to interrupt, when you say you removed the hill?
Yes.
So you mean like just taking the dirt away? It's,
yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I'm sure that wasn't fancy terminology for something else. But
no, it's just as it sounds.
Okay. All right.
It's literal. Yeah.
So the hill we removed, and that took a solid week to remove that, you know, maybe 7 or 8 feet of overburden of hill on top of the dinosaur. And the students had a day or two of excavation at bone level, and then they left at the end of 2 weeks, and then our first of our volunteer crews came in to continue their work. At the end of the day, it turned out to be a disarticulated skeleton. There weren't many bones. There was the shoulder blade. There was a femur, that's what I first thought was a vertebra. It turned out to be a meter-long thigh bone.
And when you say disarticulated, you mean like it's come apart?
Yeah, so okay. Articulated is everything's together. Disarticulated, it's all apart. So at the end of the day, we had shoulder of the femur, a rib or ischium, a hip bone. It's not clear to me what that is yet. A vertebra and a portion of skull, small portion of skull. and several smaller bones that we did collect that we haven't yet identified. It turns out that that the Triceratops died on a floodplain, and then floodplains are next to rivers, and the river flooded, and basically when rivers flood and overrun their banks, the water is traveling very fast and forcefully, and what that will do is rip up everything on a floodplain, and that's soil, so where the where muds are and bones and this sort of thing. And so all of our bones were overall in a sand, in a channel, but the bones were also were surrounded by these little clay balls, which is evidence of active transport from a floodplain into a river channel because of a flood of, a channel overflowing its banks. And so we have a bit of insight into how that locality came about in the way that it ultimately, what we ultimately uncovered. So it turned out not to be a complete skeleton, but we did collect what's there, except the femur was sitting on a concrete hard sandstone bench. And we didn't discover that till the last, two or three days. And that bench was so hard that we couldn't excavate through it. So Andrew actually bent a metal spike on it. Like we're talking almost, the sandstone is almost like steel. So what we had to do was winterize that bone. It's still in Montana. We have to return for it. It's not the only bone we've had to winterize over the years. And so we'll hopefully be in Montana again, 25, to retrieve it, but with some demolition grout in hand. So we can, which we learned about on our last day from staff of the Museum of the Rockies, recommended this straightforward approach of breaking through solid rock. So we'll try that in 25.
Interesting. Andrew, I suspect you hope you'll be on hand for that.
Yes, yes, I do.
Sounds I was going to say groundbreaking. I don't mean the pun, but but I mean a new way of doing something and so on. When I Googled you, Andrew, I needed to be reminded of who you were and your sort of place in the program. What came up was a short article on the Carthage website, and I think it involved a Triceratops skeleton that had been found, and you were quoted as being very excited about it. And I'm pretty sure you used the word charismatic. Charismatic remains or a charismatic creature. I forget what it was, but tell us more about your relationship with the Triceratops and then this particular specimen.
Yeah, well, this specimen is it was named Don after a former volunteer, Justin Coates is his name. He found it back in 2016, right? Yeah, he named it after his mother. His mother's name was Don. But I've been working on this for some time, on and off. Like if I'm given T-Rex stuff, that takes priority. But then I come back to this. It is a partial Triceratops skull. It is basically the snout, so tip of the beak to a little bit before where the eyes would have been, essentially. So nasal horn and everything else is there. It was. I began working on it when it was still in the jacket, unflipped. There was quite a bit of ironstone on top of that side of it. So just chipping away the ironstone, because at the time we weren't sure if any of the bone was inside of that stone.
Oh, okay.
So we had to use an air scribe on that. It's like almost like a miniature jackhammer. It's got this metal spike that vibrates. And so then you chip it off with that. And just that process alone took like 60 hours.
Wow.
Getting that rock off. Not to say nothing of actually working on the bone. So then once the jacket was flipped, the bone itself is very broken up. As Dr. Carr mentions, that's what happens in Hell Creek. You have extremes in temperature in Montana. If it gets very hot and dry in the summer and gets cold and snowy in the winter. Same reason why cracks show up in sidewalks. Bone, same thing happens to bone.
Sure.
But this is in clay, which is much harder to clean off than sand. Sand you can just kind of brush off. Clay you need water and toothbrushes and stuff to get everything off. So I've basically been pulling it apart and cleaning it and putting it back together piece by piece. But But yeah, like a lot of times people talk about like, you know, charismatic species and stuff like that, like big impressive things that, you know, get people's attention.
Right. And Triceratops certainly qualifies.
That's one of those, yeah.
And you know, as you're talking, it really underscores the fact that when you are a paleontologist, you probably spend more time dealing with dirt than you do with the actual remains. I mean, that so much a part of this is extracting these things out of the dirt or getting the dirt off of it or whatever. I mean, seems like the interaction you have, it's a whole lot about that.
Yeah, it definitely can be. Yeah. Yeah, it depends a little bit on what you do. Some people do different things with this, of course, but yeah, it definitely can be that way.
Hmm. Dr. Carr, you mentioned the process of winterizing when you want something to be at least somewhat protected from the elements in order for you to return to it. Is that winterizing process long and elaborate and sophisticated, or is it a fairly cut-and-dried matter?
No, it's not sophisticated at all. It's just... is bury the thing.
Oh,
basically.
Oh, really? Just
what we did with the femur is we did put a field jacket on it to protect it from, you know, moisture and all that, and also just to save us that work in 25. Then we put a couple tarps on top of that to keep, you know, rain and melt water away from the jacket because it's plaster. And then we just buried it with the hill. So we removed the hill, and then we put part of it back to bury that fossil so that it wouldn't be uncovered over the course of the next year.
Interesting.
So it's straightforward.
Wow. And you are back in 2025. So next summer,
if,
you hope.
If and only if we get funding to do that.
Right, right.
And so our situation there is still existential.
Sure. You mentioned, Dr. Carr, that part of what made this kind of an interesting experience out in Montana this summer was the presence of not one, not two, but three different film crews on hand.
Yes.
Tell us why there were film crews in and around what you and your group were doing.
Right. So I think this speaks to the success of the program, sort of on the backs of our students and volunteers and the profile that we've gained from that, the hard work of Dr. Seitz contributing to it, has drawn a lot of media attention. So we're a peak on the landscape of the media. They're aware of us and aware of our challenges too. The first film crew was out with us for the first week to film the T-Rex, just see how that would shake out. And that was Silver City. This is a documentary film company based in Milwaukee. And they're working on a doc on the commercial side of paleontology and how that affects the science. Our story has become sort of a narrative thread or a coat hanger for that film. So they're quite interested to see what that locality would turn up. In the second week, we had a film crew from IMAX that are working on a film on T-Rex, and they filmed us at the Triceratops quarry, and also just sat down and interviewed me about, you know, T-Rex controversies, this sort of thing, the work I've done. And then we had, in week four, a very special volunteer who's been out with us before in 21. This is Mr. Christopher Dudney. He's a multiple award-winning poet and nonfiction author from Canada, who teaches at York University there. And he's has had such a notable career that a film documentarian named Brian Johnson took an interest in Christopher's career, and they're doing a doc on his career. And they're starting with us. Apparently, there's several themes, and we fulfilled the theme of Earth. Brian knew that Christopher was going to join us for the final week, and so that they were out with us to film Christopher in action digging dinosaurs. And it was also quite nice. They interviewed me as well about my connection to Christopher, And also they discovered that there were several poets in the quarry.
Huh.
And so it turned out that they interviewed Andrew and also one of our other alums, Amelia Zietlow, who's now in New York doing her PhD there.
Wow. Very good. So at least some of this will we get to see someday?
Yes, definitely. All three docks, you know, those trains have left the station. And yeah. So I don't know the timelines on those. I think Silver City might be fairly close. IMAX might be close with something. I think with Brian Johnson's dock on Christopher, that might be a few years out,
wow.
out yet.
Would be exciting to see that.
Oh, yeah.
I want to be sure to ask Andrew, although Dr. Carr, you would know as well the answer to this, but how hot was it? I mean, we've been so blessed right here in southern Wisconsin with a, for the most part, incredibly lovely summer while so much of the country has baked. So just how hot was it out there in Montana? And what kind of conditions were you working in?
It was a dry heat, so it wasn't that bad. But I think the highest it got was, what, 110?
Yeah, it's Christopher. It's funny, Christopher Duden, he had a thermometer going in the shade in the quarry. And so he checked, you know, several times a day how hot it got. So, yeah, 110 sounds right.
The wow. sand itself would kind of absorb some of the heat, too. So the like when we were digging in the quarry, when we got down to the bone level, we were on, you know, hands and knees with trowels, scraping everything off side by side so we wouldn't pop any bones out, or we'd ideally avoid that at least.
Right.
But, yeah, he set up the thermometer on the sand because it, reflecting the heat from the sun, it was hotter on the sand than it was just in the air. So 110 is the measure of just the ambient air temperature. The thermometer in the sand, like that, he said that got up to, like, 120 or something like that, right?
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
I imagine when you sign on to do this at the outset, that's not necessarily something you're maybe even emotionally or mentally prepared for, is what it's going to be like to work in those conditions.
Yeah, some people definitely aren't expecting that when they go out. Yeah, they're taken a little bit off guard by it.
Right. And it did force our hand. In the last week, we split the day. Like, usually we were in the quarry from early morning to 4, and we'd head back to the house. But last week it got so hot that we'd work until noon and then leave, have an early dinner, and then return at, you know, leave the house at 4:30 and work straight through till past sunset, which was wow. actually worked really well. I know I was a little skeptical at first, but it really did bring people around. People rallied, people enjoyed it. Like, as the sun sets, the quality of light changes, the temperature, of course, goes down, and it's just a more pleasant working conditions, because sure. you're not toiling around in the hottest part of the day.
There was one evening as well where it wasn't even evening, it was night, we had headlamps on. It was just a few of us going out there, but that was actually really nice. Huh. We stayed out till like
11
past 11. Yeah.
Wow.
And yeah, night digging is fun, it's pleasant,
I suppose. It's tricky, and yet you're not getting heat stroke, or yeah. one hopes not. Yes. Yeah. Wow. Well, it sounds like it was yet another amazing field expedition, and I appreciate the opportunity to kind of hear all about what happened and what you hope, if you are able to return, the kind of things you're going to be able to explore. We have just 2 or 3 minutes, I'm afraid, Dr. Carr, but I do want to give you an opportunity to just kind of touch on some of the funding concerns that I know have weighed heavily on you, and of course are deeply worrisome in terms of the program, its well-being, and where it's headed, and so on. What do you want to tell us in terms of an update?
Well, at the current moment, the program's literally dead on its feet. Back in 2020, without any explanation, the college administration cut the fossil preparator position, which they had agreed to in the agreement with the city. So they turned their backs on that. We scrambled for funding. And as Andrew mentioned, that just ran out last Thursday. In the meantime, given that, you know, basically that funding in terms of salary was basically poverty level wages. Dr. Seitz did take a job that recognized her talents in Colorado. And so without the fossil preparator or assistant to the paleontologist, we lose in one stroke 2/3 of the program. Mm-hmm. I mentioned earlier the three legs of the stool: field, lab, research. Without the preparator, we lose 2/3 of the program, which means in one stroke we become uncompetitive against other undergraduate programs like ours. And we have worked 18 years to build ourselves up to get to the position that we're at. We do attract students, good numbers of them. Last year, the numbers showed that we had 15 students identify paleontology as what their concentration would be. And lowballing tuition, that's just under $250,000. So in terms of attracting students, the program pays for itself and then some. And so to this point, the administration, despite repeated pleas from myself and concerned volunteers, alums, members of the public, parents, and students, the administration refuses to fund that position. We're talking about a salary that's less than $40,000 a year. And also we've sought help from the city to see if they'd be interested in rescuing the program, and they also have turned their backs on us. And so we are forced into the corner of desperately seeking funding in a current climate where foundations are no longer willing to support salary. So the grant that we did have did support salary. That foundation no longer will do that. We have applied, or I have applied to them for funding for equipments and such for 5 years of field and lab. So we're in a desperate position here. Really, I think this is a trivial amount of money to keep a very successful program afloat. Just by way of contrast, the highest administrative salary from 2022 to 2024 received a bump of $132,000, going from $608,000 to $740,000 a year salary. And that, you know, that amount of money, that $130,000, could pay two preparators, with a reasonable salary of, say, $60,000 a year, or that could basically support our entire program for a year. So we know the money is there. There's just an obstinate unwillingness to share that with us.
Well, that's a sobering note on which to end, and yet I know you want to lay out the situation as clearly as you can for the sake of people, you know, from your perspective. And we certainly hope that solutions can be found one way or another to keep a very, very good program going and achieving new heights of excellence. So we'll continue to follow that situation with interest and concern. And in the meantime, on a happier note, I'm glad that we can also have the time that we took to talk about this latest journey to rural Montana and all that was involved in that experience for everyone who participated. Dr. Thomas Carr, director of the paleontology program at Carthage, and Andrew Gable, who served as preparator for this field expedition and continues to volunteer a great deal of his time for the program and the Kenosha Public Museum. I appreciate both of you being here and for all that we got to cover and talk about today. And best wishes to you all.
Thank you so much.
Thanks again for having us.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Doug Instanis from the Racine Theater Guild will join us to talk about the current production at the Guild, which is Murder on the Orient Express, and we'll also take a little time to talk about the overall season. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Today is going to be sunny and once again quite warm for this time of year, with a high temperature of 86 degrees, cooler near the lake. Clear overnight, a low of 55. Tomorrow, sunny and a high of 83. Thursday, sunny, 81. Still sunny and warm on Friday. And all the way through the weekend, the first chance of rain in our forecast is on Monday. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.